The most dangerous place you can be as a trial lawyer is to think you've got it figured out.
I'm still trying to get better. I still have the passion for it. I believe in it.
Everyone can learn to do what I do.
And yet there's a group here that continues to get extraordinary verdicts.
Trial Lawyers University is revolutionizing educating lawyers to be better trial lawyers. It's been invaluable to me.
Trial Lawyers University, where the Titans come to train. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Hello. Melissa, you made it home. At least our home for the week here at the Big Easy Lodge. So look at this great view we have. We have all of our friends here. And Melissa and I have been getting to know each other. Well, we got to know each other a little bit before we came out skiing today, because I was privileged enough to come out to the Northeast Pennsylvania Association of Trial Lawyers and teach out there and meet all the and see your town, where what's it called, Wilkes-Barre?
Scranton.
Scranton, Pennsylvania. Never been there before, and especially December. People are like, you get to go to Scranton? Yeah, I'm going to Wisconsin before that. Like, see, you just, like, some people want to be outside then, so that's why it's a good time to have a conference, so I really appreciate that. So Melissa is here with her lovely daughter, Rachel, and we got to know each other from our good friend, Philip Miller.
Yes.
Philip, finally, he'd done something for me. I'm like, Philip, I've been friends with you for 5-6 years. You've never done anything for me. Finally introduces me to you. So he's off the hook for a little while.
Good.
Because, like, but Philip's one of my favorite people. I know one of your favorites. One of, like, anybody knows me, he's kind of one of their favorite people. It's being Philip Miller. But, Melissa, you've been being a trial lawyer now for how long?
35 years.
And so from the very beginning, though, well, actually long before you went to college and but tell us a little background on, you know, your beginnings. Like, where'd you grow up and what kind of, you know, environment did you have?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Oh, just a former president.
Yeah.
So you're Scranton Melissa.
That's right.
All right.
And so I grew up in a middle class background. My father was a plant manager. My mother left nursing school and raised 4 children. I was the second oldest. I was the first person to graduate college. Neither parent went to college, but they were big proponents in education. In fact, they sent me to a prep school for high school, a Jesuit prep school. And that's what the Jesuits do. Their mission is teaching. And so I learned in law school, or in high school, that I really wanted to do something important, and I wanted to help people and continue to learn. And I wanted to become a lawyer as far back as high school.
Well, this is, you're probably not gonna do this, but I went to Brother Rice, which is run by the Jesuit brothers. You
really?
See that?
How about that?
How about that?
That's
I didn't know their mission was teaching.
So
maybe
well.
That's why I started, that's maybe why we started Trial Lawyers University.
Right.
Because of that upbringing when I was a kid, I didn't even realize they were influencing me like that. Amazing. I was always wondering, why did I do this? It was the Jesuit brothers'
yes.
mission for teaching. So from a very young age, And so your parents encouraged the learning. And so where'd you go to high school, you know, college and law school? Like,
so I stayed in Pennsylvania. I went to Dickinson College in Carlisle, and then stayed on after college to Dickinson Law School. I didn't want to go too far. My
obviously.
Parents were not very healthy when I was in high school and college. And we were a very close family. So I wanted to go away to school, but I wanted to be close enough that if they became sick, I could get home quickly. And you know, their help, my parents' health actually was a big factor, I think, in my formative years, because we became close. And as kids, me and my siblings, we wanted to take care of them. And I think that later on, you know, influenced my becoming a plaintiff's lawyer, because I feel like I was taking care of people for a very long time.
Because both your parents, you said they weren't in the healthiest of conditions. So say more about that.
Sure. So when I was in high school, my father had a massive heart attack. He was 47 years of age. I was a freshman in high school, and he nearly died. And that was obviously pretty traumatic. And in fact, I remember all of us kids being summoned to the hospital to pretty much say goodbye to him in the ICU. He survived. He was a very tough guy. And ultimately lived to age 86. So, you know, it's a happy ending there. But, you know, it was something that when you're young and your life changes on a dime like that, is pretty influential. And then a few years later, my mother was diagnosed with end-stage renal disease, which is kidney disease. And so, you know, as a family, we were always taking care of her and looking after her. And so I didn't go far to school because I wanted to be close by. And we remained as a very close family, a very nurturing family, a loving family. I had a wonderful upbringing and fortunate in many ways.
Well, in law school, did you do any participate in the trial team or mock trial or trial ad that helped you kind of develop your presence?
Yeah, I did. I think from kind of taking care of my parents, I sort of from high school became kind of a take charge person. We were always a very athletic family, and I was always very competitive. So when I decided, as I looked at careers, what was suitable for me, I liked advocacy. I liked taking charge. I liked caring for people. I was empathetic to people's suffering. And so I decided early on I wanted to be a trial lawyer. So when I got to law school, I wasn't the best student. I figured all I had to do was graduate, right?
I agree.
I mean, I figured once I got there, you know, that's okay. I didn't have to be the first in my class. But I was lucky because the head of the trial program was a like nationally recognized instructor in trial advocacy. And I said, I'm going to make the trial team because I want to be a trial lawyer. And my focus in law school was really my trial advocacy class and making the team and competing because I was a natural competitor I knew that's what I wanted to be, so I was very driven.
Did you win any awards?
Yeah, I did, actually.
Well, let's hear about them, because right. Nothing like predicts future success, like, you know, future results, like success in trial ad in law school, for God's sake.
Yeah, so during my second year, I took the class, trial advocacy, and based on your performance in second year, the professor decided who would be on the team, so I made the team, and I made captain of the...
Captain?
Captain.
Rachel, do you know Melissa was the captain of the trial team?
I don't know if I ever told her that.
Yeah, because you're so modest.
I'm very modest.
The modesty, you don't be bragging about, is captain of the trial team. Okay, yeah. So you started to get some...
Yeah, so at graduation, I got the award from the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, award in advocacy. I was captain, which meant that I was, no matter what side of the case we were competing, whether it was the prosecution or the defense, I was always on. I was always one of them competing. So that was awesome. And so when I got out of law school, I went back and was teaching in the program. But it was so formative because I decided that, of course, that I wanted to go with the best firm and learn from other really good trial lawyers. So I took a job clerking for a civil trial judge so I could watch other lawyers and then pick who I wanted to go and work for and win.
Wow, that was very, very good discipline and foresight for a law student or law school graduate, because like I had no clue what I was doing when I was getting out of law school. So the fact that you already knew that, and so you did your year there, and tell us about where do you start your actual trial lawyering career since you had like a 1 year warm up for it.
Yeah, so I decided I wanted to work for this law firm called Horrigan, Kluger & Quinn. It was a regional law firm in northeastern PA, a bunch of offices, 30-some lawyers, and it was headed by a really phenomenal trial lawyer. In fact, he's an inner circle guy now, Joe Quinn. And I applied, and he knew Gary Gilden, who was my advocacy professor, and he called Gary and said, this law clerk applied, she listed you as a reference, you know, what do you think? And he said, you got to hire her.
You must have said something good because you got the job.
Yeah, she's like a dog on a bone, so she'll work hard.
All right. And so you get hired there at this prestigious trial firm. And tell us about, because you don't work there still, do you?
No, I was there 12 years.
12 years. So tell us about this 12-year journey at this prestigious firm.
So I had a phenomenal run there. I became partner in 4 years. I was the first woman partner there. I walked in the door and said, I want to try cases. And I want to get in the courtroom as fast as possible. And I'll try anything. And so I got a lot of opportunities.
A lot of anything.
Or maybe things that maybe. And most of them were pretty, we call them dog bite cases. They were cases that nobody wanted to try. And so, in fact, some of my first cases were defense cases because at that time, we did plaintiff and defense work. Our firm had all kinds of insurance companies. And we defended for, you know, State Farm, Progressive, Aetna, a ton of carriers. And there were a lot of little cases. So unlike today, when young lawyers have very little opportunity to get in the courtroom early, especially civil lawyers, I had amazing opportunities. So I started trying automobile defense cases for insurance companies and winning cases. And then, you know, my partners, if they didn't want to try something, like I used to get a case like on a Wednesday and somebody would say, you know, can you pick a jury on Monday on this case? And I was like, awesome, of course I can. So I took every opportunity to do that. But we also had plaintiff's cases and I really loved getting to know the clients. And I loved winning because winning, like I'm competitive. I came out of the womb.
Wait,
competitive.
You like winning?
I like winning.
Gosh.
And I love winning defense cases. But like my first plaintiff's win, like that was just amazing. It was just amazing helping somebody, getting money for somebody, rather than
denying people justice.
I didn't like it.
I can't imagine. I hope not.
And in fact,
if you liked it, I hope you would like stay there with those.
I know. In fact, over the years, we became so successful as plaintiffs' lawyers as a firm, and I was involved in the decision. We ended up taking a very courageous step in telling all of our insurance companies, "See ya, we're going to become an exclusively plaintiffs' firm." I mean, they did med mal defense. Auto defense, and it was very lucrative. And we said, you know what? You know, it got to the point they were telling, they didn't like us doing plaintiffs' cases. You know, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't be promoting, you know, this type of thing. And Joe Quinn was like, I'm not going to be told what to do, and we're gonna be plaintiffs'
And neither
lawyers.
Is Melissa Scartelli.
Right,
gonna be told
and I
to
was
do.
Right there.
All right, so you start being plaintiffs' lawyers only.
Yeah.
And so 12 years, but how many cases did you try in those 12 years?
Well, I tried a ton of cases second chair. Mm-hmm. We had some major cases, crashworthiness cases, products cases, some of the biggest cases in the crashworthiness field we had. So I did a ton of that, and I probably tried about 5 or 6 plaintiffs' cases of my own, but they were cases that they weren't the best of cases. When I say that, great people, but I was getting the more difficult, complicated cases.
Of course, you were.
And naturally, and I'm not critical of that. But any really good case, you know, the founder of the firm, the lead guy, wanted to take it, and he had every right to do that. He was very successful. Would take the best cases, and the ones that were a little bit more problematic or challenging went to the lower tier people, even though I was a partner. But again,
apparently it doesn't mean that much at the firm you're at.
Very happy
nice title.
To do it. Yeah. So, okay. But I tried some cases that I shouldn't have won, but I won anyway. And I just, I was just always so thrilled to be doing something, making money.
But there came a time then you were not so thrilled.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think as I advanced and became more successful and in the courtroom, and I wanted the bigger cases. You know, I
really?
Wanted that. I
want. You want bigger cases to, so you get yeah. bigger verdicts and make more money? That's well, so weird. Well, but go on. I'm surprised you're a plaintiff's
lawyer. I kind of wanted to just write my own script.
You want to be in charge of your own
yeah,
life too?
I wanted that.
Wow.
I know I was very greedy.
Who's ever,
yeah.
Yeah. Very selfish of you.
Yeah. Very selfish. And you know, there became a time that, you know, it was kind of a who moved my cheese. I don't know if you read the book, but. You know, it was like, how far can I kind of got as far as I thought I would go. And so I decided that I'm gonna start my own firm, which looking back, I don't know, it was crazy. I had none of my own clients. I was never marketed. I didn't have to be marketed. Nobody knew me. There were no lawyers in my family. I had no like book of business. I was nothing really, like in terms of a name or a brand. But I decided 12 years in, I went to the firm and said, I'm gonna go out on my own.
So how long you had your own practice now?
So I've been in my own practice for 25 years.
So 2001?
2001, yeah.
2001, and your practice, your name, your law firm now is Scartelli and
Olszewski. My husband is a partner of mine, and in life and in work, he is a former prosecutor, a former judge in Luzerne County, and then left the bench after 10 years and joined me. And I changed the name of the firm to Scartelli Olszewski, and we have our daughter, who's a lawyer with us. Rachel Olszewski, very thrilled. She has
We're all thrilled that
new
Rachel's
energy,
part of the, I
new
know.
Energy to the firm. She's been with us 5 years. Rachel's a third-generation lawyer. Her grandfather was an appellate judge in Pennsylvania.
Prestigious bloodlines.
Yes, yes.
All right.
And you are helping form her to become an amazing trial lawyer. And that's how I met you. Because, and through Philip Miller, because Rachel's at the point where we need her to start trying her own cases. And I called Philip and I said, what is a good and excellent trial program for a young lawyer to learn trial skills? Because we had this conversation, there aren't any trial skills programs out there. Like, the opportunity I had was amazing, and then getting into the courtroom was amazing. But these young lawyers do not have that today for reasons we all know. So Philip said, you gotta meet Dan Ambrose, and sent Rachel to Hermosa Beach, and she came
Huntington
back.
Beach.
Huntington Beach.
We'll be sending her to Hermosa Beach. That's gonna be the,
okay.
that's the location of the new
okay,
TLU trial pad.
Okay.
But we've been having residence annually in Huntington Beach at the Paseo Hotel, and we'll be holding residence there this year again from June 2nd through June 6th. So you're gonna make your debut there. So we were talking about that, which is very exciting because we have, for sure, the greatest trial program ever put together. And people say it to me, and my friends, and they always say, Dan, you say that every year. And I'm like, but then before I can answer, like, and you're right, you do it. But then of course it's gonna be, then. It is going to be better this year because not just because Melissa's coming. That is one thing that's going to make it better. But we got dinner Tuesday night with my friend Virash from Finch Legal, and then Scott Frost. We're closing it down on Sunday morning with a brunch, and then on Wednesday our friend Ted Wacker is taking a whole bunch of us out to go golfing. So we have cool stuff, and the greatest trial lawyers coming to teach with lecture tracks and workshops and you know, theme parties and so much learning and so much friend making. It's crazy and fun,
right.
Too, on top of the wall at the beach. That's why, being that we have such a great time every year at the beach, that's why we decided, you know what, we should move just to Hermosa Beach. So it just doesn't have to be 5 days a year. We can kind of live that dream closer to 365. Might have to do some work in between there and leave town, but that's
sure.
life, you know? This is the crosses we must bear. So, but this is about Melissa. First of all, how was skiing today?
It was incredible.
Wasn't it fucking awesome?
Day.
It was like
yes.
Perfect sunshine.
Yes.
The snow was great. It was, you know, powdery. Very few ice patches.
Blue sky.
Blue skies.
No wind.
No wind. Long and flat. And just, it was a picture. What's what they call it? My friend Connell Doyle. Bluebird Day.
So we
got a Bluebird Day.
Yeah, had after 3 hours of training this morning, too.
Well, that's because we're here for business. That's right.
Right.
Training, breakfast, skiing. We have a little downtime for an hour, but here we're doing our podcast, though.
Yes.
And then more training tonight.
Right.
Because
it's brutal, but it's good.
Brutal. It's exciting.
It's
brutal.
It's good. It's good.
So now we're on the training. So we're going to talk about your success, but you know, for somebody that's had yours, because like you've had tremendous success, you tried a lot of cases, and so now we're training, and so we did a little bit of training in Pennsylvania, that was light though, that was very light, mm-hmm. very limited preparation. This one we did a lot more preparation for. So, how do you, what have you learned? What have you learned about? Well, today we did We've been working on cross examination real hard. So, you've crossed a few witnesses in the courtroom.
I have crossed a few witnesses in the courtroom. And I have to say, it has really been eye-opening being involved with the training, with your training at Trial Lawyers University, because I've had a lot of success in the courtroom, and I feel as though I'm pretty good, and I know how to win a case. But frankly, I have so much more to learn about my performance skills. And I really never focused on how I look, the taglines, maybe awkward movements, some repetitive words. So I'm learning that I really need some honing in on performance skills that I really thought I had it all covered. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's hard to get to the point where you're trying cases 35 years and you realize, wow, there's a lot more I should be doing or thinking about, and I could be even more effective. And I'm not just saying that, to you, building you up. When you come to one of these programs and you see yourself on video doing things and seeing some perhaps awkward movements or stiffness or it's really eye-opening, and it's amazing. So what you've got going is a pretty good deal here, and it's something that I highly recommend, especially to lawyers starting out, but frankly, for lawyers of all skill levels, because we know as trial lawyers, the learning never ends. And if you get to the point where you think you know everything, or you've got all bases covered and you're top, well, guess what? You're not. Juries change. The way you process information, the way people process information changes. Attention spans, are vastly diminished compared to when, of juries when I started out. And there's constantly things to learn. So it's really been eye-opening and pretty awesome, actually. And I'm looking forward to coming out to the program in California. But really, I got a little bit of this in December when you came to Pennsylvania. But we've been at this a few days now. And I really think that I can't wait to try my next case, because I'm going to be more thoughtful about my performance and what I'm doing in the courtroom, in addition, obviously, substantively, as to what's going on in the case. I think it's just awesome.
TLU Huntington Beach is going to be the greatest event of 2026. There's going to be 4 lecture tracks, 8 workshop tracks with the top trial lawyers in the country. On Tuesday, June 2nd, there's going to be a golf outing and also a pickleball outing. That night, we're going to have a dinner at the La Rea. We're going to buy it out so everybody gets a chance to meet each other beforehand. And then during the conference, of course, we do a full breakfast, full lunch, and theme parties every night. This year, we're going to be utilizing the pool area and the restaurant for more of the parties. And we're going to have an adult swim right one night, a Satch Oliver party on Friday night. And the last theme party is going to be a 80s Run DMC Adidas jumpsuit. It's going to be the greatest. And last year we had over 800 people. This year it's going to be over 1,000. So if you want to be part of it all and you want to stay at the Paseo Hotel, don't delay because it sells out fast and then you're going to be in the overflow. Can't wait to see you there. TLU Beach.
Well, it's about being intentional with everything we do. And my friend Dave Clark, who was my mentor, he said it's about making the unconscious conscious. Mm-hmm. And that's what the goal is. Because like unconsciously, we're all comfortable. We're all good storytellers.
Right.
But as soon as somebody says, tell me a story and puts pressure on a person, that's like they become robotic. And it's only their conscious mind they draw from and not their unconscious mind. Whereas we're just hanging out, we're telling us, talking stuff, remembering stuff. It's our unconscious mind. And to do the repetition of these skills, because skill is an unconscious thing. It's a matter of, a repetition of a controlled movement. So you do it so many times that you can do it without thinking. For like a basketball player shooting a ball or a tennis player, swinging the racket. Like, Serena Williams doesn't have to think when she takes the racket back and swings, and Michael Jordan doesn't have to think when he pulls up for a jump shot. And, as trial lawyers, we don't have to think about deploying certain, skills in the courtroom because we've practiced them so much before it's game time, they just flow out of us. And that's when it's, people get presence, people get comfort, people learn to relax, relax. It's all about, the repetition to help build the presence. And that's what we're trying, that's what we're doing here. With using a model case like this trucking case where we have a dash cam video and we have photographs from the scene so we can all witness the crash, because then in the story part in every aspect of trial, not just opening and closing but on cross-examination, to take the jury out of the jury box and transport them to the scene, not just the scene of the crash to make them witnesses, but to the scene of the hospital so they can see the struggle of the suffering, take them to the scene of the home, so they witness the struggle of these injured people trying to find a life again, and the struggle with the pain and survival. So that's what I think our job is. And besides getting these skills, but we talked a lot about growing up and learning to empathize, and because you've had quite a few cases, and that I want to ask you about actually. Because I'm so, especially like, because you tried quite a few products cases in your career, is that right?
Yeah.
About how many products trials would you say you've been party to?
Well.
Or part of?
Yeah, I've been probably a part of close to 10 products cases, several automobile crashworthiness cases. I tried a case involving a defective bucket truck. It was one of my first cases. When I opened my firm, I had no business when I opened the firm, but thankfully I had a lot of friends, a lot of former partners who would send me cases, but they were cases that were the difficult cases,
of course,
right? No one was sending me any
If you had a lot of time as starting your own
leg, nobody was sending me a bus full of neurosurgeons who got in a crash, so. I was trying the most problematic, challenging cases. And one of the cases I got was a product liability case against an aerial bucket company. I represented a tree trimmer. And he was electrocuted in a bucket truck trimming trees. And he was so badly burned. It was amazing he survived. The damages in the case were huge. He was burned, like 3/4 of his body went right into a power line. And because the wire hooked down to the bucket, it grounded him. So he completed the circuit. And he was in a burn center for months. In fact, his burns were so bad, he had to have what was called leech therapy. They actually got leeches from somewhere and they would put leeches on his wounds, and the leeches would suck the blood from him, and he would sit there, and once they got really big and fat, he would have to take them off and put another leech on. It was the most horrifying injury I had ever seen. And But the liability was challenging because built into the trial story was, you know, the defense of it was his fault. He got too close to the wire.
The defendant blamed the victim.
The defendant blamed the victim because he hit a power line, and all the standards say you have to be so far apart from the lines. The standards are so, you know. It was not in favor of my client. The standards were for the industry, and if you followed the standards, you'd never be able to trim a tree. It wouldn't get close to a wire, okay? So it was built in, there was a built-in excuse to blame my client. But what really happened was the bucket, you know, there wasn't a good stopping system for the bucket, and the bucket lunged, and he couldn't stop it in time, and he ended up in the wire. And so we had a very good theory about the controls being defective, and I had a great expert. Midway through, you know, the developing the case, my expert passed away. I was putting a ton of money into the case. There are biomechanics, engineering, injuries. I mean, there was so much involved, and this was early in my law firm. So I went to a local, one of my mentors, an older gentleman who tried a lot of products cases, and I said, I should bring in somebody else to do this with me. I was into this case a couple $100,000. I'm looking at a trial. It was a 4-week trial. I should really partner. And that wasn't me, because at that point, I was trying anything and everything, and I never showed any, you know, fear, if you will, of, you know, taking on anybody. But I said, you know, I should probably partner with somebody. And he said, well, I don't want your case. It's, you know, pretty complicated case. But, you know, there's this big guy in Philadelphia. He's the guy. When he's on a case, everybody quakes. And you should talk to him. And long story short, I talked to him. He said, yeah, I'll try this case with you. We'll run this together. So he signed on. Client was great with that. And he pretty much ghosted me after that. It was like unbelievable. Couldn't get in touch with him, never got involved, didn't help out. I was nearing like discovery deadlines, expert witness deadlines, and I said, well, I'm not giving up on this client. And so I said, I'm gonna try this case. So I put on this huge case, had all these experts, and I had, when my liability case was in, one of the jurors got sick, and the judge declared a mistrial. And
there were alternates?
There were alternates, but it was kind of a crazy, the guy had shingles, there was a pregnant lady on the jury. He thought, you know, everybody could be sick or get shingles, so he sent everybody home. I had, like I said, my liability case in, hundreds of thousands of dollars in this case, mistrial. Well, the defense loved that, right? So then we come back, 6 months later, I try the case for 4 weeks, lose the case. And
hold on a second. So this is your second trial, you're hundreds of thousands, and you lose the case.
I lose the case.
Like, what was that like?
It was devastating. First of all, it was so hard for my client, right? This guy, you know, was just, you know, injured, maimed, in pain for the rest of his life. Wasn't his fault. He was in a very old, defective bucket. It was devastating. But also, I was convinced that the trial judge made a substantial error in the case. He let in a hearsay document, an investigative report that blamed my client. And I argued like mad, saying this is irrelevant, it's prejudicial, you can't let this report in, because even though it was a crashworthiness case, the defense on causation blamed my client. The judge let this report in, blaming my client, and I lost on causation. And so I said, I'm appealing the case, I'm not letting this go. And I think a lot of people would have let it go. I appealed the case and I won on appeal.
You handled the appeal yourself?
Yeah, my office did.
But you?
Yeah, myself and my associate, we wrote the brief, argued the case.
It'd be so hard to write an appellate brief on a trial that you've done twice and got screwed on. just to constantly read those transcripts and relive that horrific, traumatic event.
Yeah, no, it was. And you know, I didn't go to law school to be an appellate lawyer either, right? So now I'm in the appellate court.
Like, the fact that you could do an appeal, I can't even imagine writing a brief, let alone doing an appeal.
So all of a sudden, so I won the appeal. Good news. Bad news is I got to try this case again.
In front of the same judge.
Yeah. And so by that time, the funniest thing about it was there was so much time and effort and money into this case on both sides that the company, the manufacturer of the bucket, they were self-insured for the first $1 million. And they had exhausted their $1 million retainer, the self-insured retainer. So all of a sudden now an insurance company finally gets involved and they learn that there's this crazy lawyer from Scranton, Pennsylvania, won't let this case go. And I get a call before the third trial, and they say, what do you think about going to mediation? And I was like, I'll mediate this case, right? If you're gonna put enough money up, I'll mediate the case. So we kind of postured a little bit, and I got a great mediator to come up from Philadelphia to Scranton. And she put us all in the room. And now the insurance company's there, and I got up at one point and said, look, you're meeting me for the first time. I know you probably heard about me, and I'm gonna tell you right now, I'm gonna try this case again. If you don't come up with enough money, I'm not afraid to try this case again. I'm gonna win this case, and I'm not gonna let this case go until I win. So you gotta come up with a lot of money, and they did. We settled the case.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of resilience.
Yes, and my client finally got, the money he deserved, and it was a good settlement, and he was taken care of. But there were a lot of lessons in that trial. But
how'd you handle? The whole thing. I can't even imagine. I know there's lessons in every trial, but that sounds like too much learning for me.
Perseverance, I think. I think,
that was the first lesson.
Perseverance. But, and that's just, the way I am. When I founded the firm, I said, I'm going to worry about this, my client. Not going to worry about money. If I worry about money and making money, it's not going to happen. If I take care of every client I have, the money will come. And the people will be best served. And so, I just constantly just kept thinking about him. And, I know from growing up, in an instant, your life could change and what suffering's about, worry and anxiety and money problems. And so I was worried about him. And that's how I've kind of focused my practice, worrying about everybody in front of me and taking care of them as best I can.
Takes a lot of energy, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Right. But I want to talk to you about maybe a case I won.
Yeah, how about that? No, I know, because you do a lot. Well, because you really focus on medical malpractice.
Yes, I do.
And that's kind of your niche. And so you would tell me about, a trial that you did. And that had to do with a young man who was misdiagnosed with a tumor or something?
No, it was an
Tell him, what was it about?
Yeah, so this was a young guy. He was 16 at the time, and he was misdiagnosed. He thought he had a hemorrhoid, and he said to his mom, I got this hemorrhoid, and she made an appointment at the local clinic. And at that point, he's 16, and she goes to the clinic with him, and she's kind of in a quandary because she knows the doctor's going to pull down his pants. He's a tough guy. He's a football player. He's a rugged kid, and he's embarrassed with his mother in the room, and she doesn't want to inject herself, and she thought, I'll let him go into the clinic with the doctor. It was a resident because it's a hemorrhoid, right? So he goes into the clinic, and the resident talks to him. He said, I think I have this hemorrhoid. I have this pain. And the resident decides to prescribe him just Preparation H without looking at his bottom. And the kid gets the Preparation H, or the prescription dose of that. And for like 8 months, he's putting Preparation H, but he doesn't have a hemorrhoid. He has a pilonidal abscess, which is actually in the crack of his butt, up high. And it's an abscess that can tunnel and become pretty devastating. It's not a tumor, it's not cancer. It's just a pretty really invasive abscess that's hard to cure unless you get it early. So now he's got 8 months of Preparation H on the abscess, and ultimately, when he's diagnosed, it had tunneled into his bottom, and he had so many surgeries to like debride, cut it out, clean it out. And he was such an amazing kid. I mean, this started when he was 16. He goes the rest of his high school years playing basketball, working at Lowe's, stuffing paper towels in his underwear because he was bleeding all the time. Surgeries weren't working. He had to keep going back. He goes to the local college. By that time, like 3 years in, he's got a wound vac. It's not healing. And he's sitting in class with a wound vac and a hose coming out of his butt with a little machine gurgling, sucking out the abscess from his butt. But he never misses work, never misses school, never misses doing chores for his mom. He's just a beautiful kid. And so thankfully, ultimately, he gets in the hands of the right surgeon and does major surgery on his butt, kind of closes up the top of his butt. And so his butt cheek is a little lower. He's got a flap, and he's cured. And so we sued the resident, the clinic, et cetera, and they don't want to offer any money because he's a young kid, he's cured, no wage loss, no medical bills, and he has a scar on his butt. That's his damage. But the kid went through hell, right? In Pennsylvania, we can't ask for a specified sum of money. This was a pain and suffering case on a kid who has a good future, who's cured. They offered peanuts to try the case.
What's peanuts, 100 grand?
100 grand. So
what was his demand? What did he want?
We looked at the case and all of the problems, you know, with damages in terms of the future and so forth. And, you know, I think our demand was like $450,000. And they wouldn't pay it. And so they forced us to try the case. And we even tried to compromise it in the middle. And I had said, and I've said this a lot to in settlement negotiations, look, you're not offering enough for my client to make any difference to my client after costs and fees at this point. It's my money that is put into the trial, not his. If he loses, he's not out anything. You're not offering him any money. You're the ones with the risk here, not him. And this isn't going to break me if I lose this case, so pay him the money. They wouldn't pay him the money. So we go to trial, and we try for a couple of days. And again, I can't ask for a specified
sum of money. And there's no medical bills, no lost wages, nothing to anchor.
Yeah. And when I go to trial, I say to my client, we're going to get the verdict, whatever it is. We're going to take it, no emotion, just if it's a win, great, no jumping around, no acting crazy. If you lose, we sit there, you know, we take it. And so we're waiting for the verdict, and the jury comes back, the foreman stands up, and the verdict's $10 million. And everybody froze. And it's so funny, I'm like, did they just say $10 million? I leaned over to my client. He was like, I said, did they just say $10 million? He was like, yep. He was like afraid to speak, but we were thrilled. And you know, we were so stoic, and we were obviously very thrilled. The jury leaves the courtroom, and then, you know, we talk to the judge, and the next thing you know, there's a knock on the door, and the jury comes in, the foreperson, and says, I just want to make sure the plaintiff is happy. Because we really like him, and we're just hoping we gave enough money. And so that was pretty awesome.
Be sure to join us in Winter Park, Colorado, March 14th through 21st. We're going to be doing a ski and trial skills boot camp. So we'll be skiing every day, but in the morning and in the evenings, we'll be working on your trial skills. That means witness prep and direct examination, cross-examination, presentation skills, which are opening statement and closing argument, and of course, jury selection. And remember that your entire tuition will be donated to the fight against Uber in California, because they're trying to destroy our civil justice system. And they're starting with California, but if they win here, your state may be next. So join the fight and come to Winter Park.
I bet it was. And because of course awesome. I asked you, did you collect it? And what'd
yeah,
you say?
I did.
Every cent.
Every penny.
Every penny.
They
plus
did
interest.
Appeal it, but the day before their brief was due in the appellate court, they paid every dime.
Well, that must have been nice, yeah. Especially yeah. You know, having your own firm and stuff.
Yeah. That actually, to this day, is still the highest verdict for pain and suffering in Luzerne County history. There was one, and the highest medical malpractice pain and suffering case. There was one case since then which had huge economics. It was like $12 million. But that case is still the highest pain and suffering. I mean, you know, it's when you can't ask for a sum, it's challenging.
I bet.
Know? Yeah.
Like, how did you think, like, how did you articulate to help them see the $10 million? I mean.
Well, you know, the strategy that we used worked. You know, our client was such a good witness, we put him up as a first witness. And he did an amazing job. And we basically say to the jury, look, you know, this is our system. You know, we put on, and I tell the jury early, you're going to hear from family members, friends, what the suffering was that this young man went through. Not to garner your sympathy, but so that you can understand, because at the end of the case, you're going to have to use your collective wisdom and award a sum of money, should we prove our case, that's a fair trade for what he went through. And you're going to have to decide the value of that. And I can't tell you what amount that is. I'm not allowed to tell you what that is. I can't give you the sum. But I'm giving you the information so that you can understand fully, so that you can decide what's a fair trade for what happened here, for this malpractice and the doctor not even taking the time to look at this young man's problem, just handing him a prescription and not looking at it, not taking the time to even understand why he's there.
Well, they did a good job coming up with a number.
Yeah, they did based a great
upon,
job.
I mean, that's a lot of trust. Good job with the trust, yeah. There. And then you also told me a little bit of a case where a young man lost his finger.
Yeah, I had,
What did you love about that case?
So what I loved about that case was that, well, first of all, my client was a great guy, another hardworking, single, great guy, family kid, young man in his 20s. The doctor was a jerk. He was so mean to my client. Ultimately, the doctor blew him off after the malpractice. So let me just give you the background. My client goes to him because he had a lump on his finger, and he had it for weeks, and it was getting worse and worse. It was his left ring finger. It was an orthopedic surgeon, and the orthopedic surgeon ultimately took a biopsy, and the biopsy came back equivocal. The pathologist said this could be a cancer, an osteosarcoma. But I'm not an expert in bone pathology. So I'm going to send the pathology out to the Mayo Clinic to be sure. So it could be cancer. I'm going to send it out to be sure. The orthopedic surgeon called my client in and said, you have cancer. It's highly aggressive. If it spreads to your lungs, you're dead. We need to remove it right away. Never told him that the pathologist's diagnosis was equivocal, and removed his finger. And then ultimately, when the pathology came back as not cancer, and he didn't need to lose his finger, the orthopedic surgeon basically said, oh well, and just kind of blew him off after that. He had neuromas, he had pain, he was trying to get help and get therapy, and the orthopedic surgeon said, essentially, it's no big deal. Never sent him to therapy.
What'd they offer on the case?
Nothing. They offered him zero.
What'd you demand?
My demand was $1.5 million. And they offered nothing. And the adjuster went so far as to tell the judge he will never offer me any money on the case because it was personal. The adjuster didn't like me because I got sanctions against them in a discovery dispute earlier in the case because they wouldn't turn over documents. And so he literally told the judge, this is personal. She's going to try the case. And so I had a punitive damage case against the doctor. And we got a $1.5 million verdict, including punitive damages against the doctor in that case.
See that? You got exactly, that a rarity, you get punitive damages against the doctor?
Very rare. I've gotten two punitive damage verdicts in Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, and I don't know anybody else who has. And I don't know anybody else who's ever gotten punitive damages against a doctor either. And we did in that case. But that case was also challenging because we started that case, and several days into the trial, the defense lawyer got sick, and we had a mistrial. And so we had to stop the case, and I retried that case to verdict.
Do you think it's easier or harder to try a case for the second time?
Harder. My case was in. So they knew, you know, by the time of the mistrial, they saw my experts.
Right.
They cross-examined my experts. But they made a very big mistake in thinking that I was going to retry it the same way.
What'd you change, Crafty?
I actually got Philip Miller involved in that case.
Oh.
And we came back to Philip and we said, we gotta mix this up and win this case. And we've got to, you know, pull some surprises.
And what did you surprise him with?
Well, we learned that the defendant doctor, he was such a wingnut. He not only was he kind of a jerk to my client, but his personality was so crazy and different and odd and unsympathetic that I decided to call him as the first witness, whereas in the first trial, I hadn't yet called him. But his demeanor and mannerisms in the courtroom were so odd, and we couldn't predict that.
You mean you tried it the first time?
Yeah, the first time. So, and my client, we did put him on the stand, and he just didn't nail it, you know? He got very nervous, yeah. So we mixed up the order. That was one of the big things. And I caught, and it's always a risk calling the defendant as of cross, the first witness, because you can control the cross, but then after that you turn them over and the defense gets their whole case in as your first witness. So in a malpractice case, that's, you know, risky.
I get it.
But we took that risk, called him first, he bombed. We did a great job cross-examining him. Jury didn't like him, and it was
smooth. That was with the skills
sailing.
You had then.
Yes.
Imagine now.
Now
you talk about
great.
Him cutting off that finger And like, oh, not even thinking, oh, poor guy doesn't have a finger.
Well, see, you know, and the defense said, hey, it's a young guy without a ring finger, big deal.
Seems like a pretty big deal to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't really, you know, think about all the things I do with it, but I know if it wasn't there, I know I'd miss it. I'm pretty certain. So Melissa, you're going to come to Huntington Beach this year. We're so excited to bring the whole family, Peter and Rachel, and we're going to have a Scartelli Olszewski party. But you're going to be teaching. We're so excited because you've been, you know, with Scranton, Pennsylvania has just been, you know, in Lucerne County has been even hiding out there. But now the big West Coast is waiting for you. So what are you going to teach in Huntington Beach?
So I'm going to teach a topic on medical malpractice. That's what I do.
That's your game. You've done product cases.
Yeah.
You can do them. You can do other cases, but medical malpractice, that's where.
That's my medical malpractice. I love medicine. I have a knack for, figuring out the medicine and strategizing, collecting experts. I've had so many medical malpractice trials. I have a long list of do's and don'ts, and I really think I should talk about practical tips, like trial practical tips, mistakes made not to make, that kind of thing. So I'm going to do something.
You probably
on
made your share
malpractice.
Of mistakes, huh?
Yeah, I mean that's how we learn, right? I mean, you know, you look anybody who thinks that they don't make mistakes. And can't learn from their mistakes. I don't know what they're doing trying cases.
No,
and so I think that, and after every case, I make a list of what lessons learned. Here's what I'm going to do different the next time. Here's what didn't work. So I think I'm going to do something very
practical.
Through
that long listings, all those things and all those lessons you've learned.
Yes.
And let all the folks know that do medical malpractice. These are the landmines I've stepped in.
Yes,
and
don't do this.
Fortunately, I'm still here, but this is how we navigate these landmines in medical malpractice, which is a little more different than any other kind of case. And, you know, I mean, honestly, especially in like California because of the caps, so very few of the great lawyers do medical malpractice. Mm-hmm. You know, other states where they don't have caps, obviously it attracts the great lawyers, but you're not gonna get a Brian Pants to do a medical malpractice case for the most he gets $500,000
and
the guy sneezes and I'm sure a $500,000 bill comes out.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
Join us March 6th and 7th in Hermosa Beach, California for our witness prep and direct examination workshop. You will learn how to transport your plaintiff and before and after witnesses back in time so they not only remember the story, but they relive it so that the jury not only hears it, but they experience it because a jury can't provide money for pain they don't feel. This program is limited to 10 participants, so register today.
So you're gonna do that, that's gonna be great. But also, I know you've been real active about the concern of a lack of trials and what can be done. So talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah, so what you and I've talked about is that unlike my upbringing, the young lawyers today don't have the opportunity. There's no trial programs. You're the only trial program that I know of, a trial skills program. I had that in law school and I had opportunities to try small cases. And now there are no big plaintiffs firms. There are not many plaintiffs firms around, and across the country, the number of civil jury trials is dramatically down. So the opportunities to try cases are less for everybody, and there are no small cases, and these young lawyers aren't getting the opportunities to get into the courtroom in a civil case as I had in my early days. In fact, Pennsylvania, through one of our Supreme Court justices, founded this project. It's called Project Litigate, to try to encourage law firms and judges to allow young lawyers to come in and try cases. But it's a real problem. And so something has to be done to help trial lawyers develop skills. Your program is one such program, but there's got to be more opportunities.
Right.
And so, that's the problem.
So here's on a side note, one thing we're doing at TLU this year is that we give law students scholarships. So last year, I think we had about 20 law students. So hopefully we're hopefully get up to 50 law students this year. So if there's any law students listening to this or anybody that has law students that work with them or for them, they want to come to the conference, they can come on a scholarship and they get to participate in workshops and meet lots of lawyers. And, you know, it's people find jobs and internships. And it's pretty darn exciting, you know, to get exposed to all this. Because, you know, I think, man, if I would have had some direction when I was young, what I could have become.
Right.
But I didn't. Faster. It's been a long, it's a hard journey. You know, I mean, I've made so many mistakes. I mean, I can't believe I'm sitting here sometimes. I've been so fortunate. But, you know, like my nephew, I mean, it'd be like all the things, but help people avoid all the mistakes and get to like greatness sooner.
Right.
So they can really enjoy a great life faster and not when they're 58 or, you know, in your case, 42. And so, you know, I mean, to try to help speed up the process.
But I think what Trial Lawyers University could do is since you're creating opportunities for law students and young people to come, they can interact with more senior lawyers and perhaps get some of the more senior lawyers to agree to mentor. Next time they're going to trial, maybe some of these law students or young lawyers get on a plane and just sit and shadow, maybe do a witness. You know, make these connections because, you know, the more connections you make, the more opportunities and you have so many great people in your group that you get in there. I'm sure they would be thrilled to invite a young lawyer to tag along.
Oh yeah, it's gonna be so great. That's why I'm so great and excited about moving to Hermosa Beach, because we start having like, you know, trainings. You know, at my house, you know, once a week, twice a week, not even with me doing it, with other lawyers doing it, but also having law students come, because there's so many law schools in LA, and that's where we're going to be living. And it's like to get to meet all these people when they're young, and, you know, the ones that are like want to be plaintiffs lawyers, you know, helping them on their journey, fast tracking, teaching them about presentation, things they've never thought about, you know, give them a faster start out the gate. Like, you know, I'm super stoked for all that. And the thing that was special about your program, you're telling me, is that if a young lawyer takes a witness and, you know, with a senior lawyer that, you know, because most courts have a rule, one lawyer per witness.
Yeah.
So then the senior lawyer can stand up and help clean up any mess or mistakes that the junior lawyer made, so ultimately the client doesn't suffer.
Right, and that's the thing. Project Litigate, that's one of the aspects of the project. If the state trial judges sign on to this, they let a young lawyer have the opportunity, and then there's no risk to the client because the senior lawyer can mop up.
Right.
And that's one such way that Pennsylvania is addressing the subject of, you know, young lawyers not getting into the courtroom. And also, our trial judges in Pennsylvania who sign on to the project, they encourage firms to send lawyers in to do young lawyers to do oral argument on cases that maybe oral argument was not necessary or not needed. They say, but you can have argument if you send one of the junior lawyers to come in and go to court.
Right.
And so there's some initiatives like that going on in Pennsylvania, which are great. I've been fortunate with my opportunities going to trial, and I've helped my husband. He's a criminal defense lawyer, and I've gotten to try some cases with him, some witnesses and so forth. I don't know anything about criminal law, but
I know a lot about it,
but
I know too much about it.
Yeah.
And it's okay.
In the last 10 years, I've second chaired criminal defense cases, doing expert witnesses, accident reconstructionists, something medical, victims I've cross-examined if it's a female victim. And
we call those accusers, by the way, in the criminal.
Yeah.
So unless our client gets convicted, then they're a victim.
That's true.
All right, let's get the right phraseology.
I don't even know the lingo. That's
we don't need to
be
getting convicted
criminal.
Too soon now by their own lawyer. That'd be not such a great thing.
So I've gotten, you know, to do that. And I think that young lawyers really should, you know, team up with maybe some criminal defense lawyers and get some opportunities that way, possibly.
Or, you know, what I'm really stoked too is like, you know, people that like have, you know, med mal cases, you know, teaming up with like lawyers like you who, mm-hmm. you know what I mean, who've been there, can like help mentor them and not just take the case and get a referral, but take the case and work it with them and give them the opportunities. That's what it's like, you know, because that's why my reason was that I'm moving back to California, because I'm licensed there and I can go to court there.
Yeah.
I wasn't licensed in Vegas. I didn't know anybody there, just a couple people. Here in California, I know lots of people. And it, you know, it's exciting to help people practice to train the basic skills here, but like applying them to actual real cases.
Right.
And so you see a person's, like, you know, like here the training, we do the training of the defense medical expert, but then we cross-examine a defendant truck driver of a real case that like Joe Freeh's doing, where we have a dash cam video, we have photos, and then you can practice, you know, doing the cross of that witness, but you're employing the skills that you just learned, right? Like, you know, the pacing, the breathing, yeah. the emotional state control. But that's how it's gonna keep continuing to get better. So here's my this will be my last question for you. So if we could go back some 35 years or so, whatever long it's been. How long have you been a lawyer?
36
yeah, years, but you just years. Get out of law school.
Yes.
And, okay, because, you know, when you start in your little clerkship there, seeing what's going on with these lawyers, who you want to go work for. But now that you have all this wisdom after 36 years and all these trials, what advice do you give young 27-year-old, whatever you are, Melissa Scartelli? What is your advice to that young lawyer? Because, you know, she wants to be a trial lawyer, so.
Right. Well, my advice is, first of all, you know, client first, okay? I think that if you focus on your client, getting to know your client, and be passionate about what you do, and never stop learning. Okay, trial lawyers are students forever. And my advice is to be passionate about what you do. And if you're not passionate and empathetic and you don't care about your client, you don't want to be a plaintiff's lawyer. And never stop learning. There's so many people you can learn from. Your skills can always get better. And just persevere and you know, take one client at a time. Don't worry about the money will come if you're passionate, you're empathetic, you're humble and know that there's always more to learn, and you stick to it, you'll be successful.
That's pretty good advice, but like, you know, I thought the same thing. If I thought become a great lawyer, the money would come, but as a criminal defense lawyer, the money never came. So it never came. You gotta be in the right area of law to get really good and have the money come, okay? Because if you're doing that, or you're doing, you know, writing wills and estates, you can become really good at it.
Yeah.
You can make a living, but you're not gonna really make money, so.
Well, that's advice to plaintiff's lawyers.
That's the plaintiff. That's the people that have the plaintiff's lawyers.
That's right.
The plaintiff's lawyers.
That's
actually,
right.
Oh, because like, you know, you said get to know your client. That's so critical, because most people never really get the story from their client. And that's why I'm really, like, I've been doing witness prep for a long time, because that's kind of like, I consider to be one of my strong suits. And so we're doing our first witness prep kind of workshop in Hermosa Beach. Mm-hmm. And that's the first one, because I'm moving, you know, to Hermosa Beach next week. So I'm really excited about that. Mm-hmm. And the people that do it, like, you know, when people really understand how to get the story from their client, and then they're really telling their clients authentic story and not the story that they think they should be telling, or the story that they want to tell that they think is the best story and not the one that actually happened, and the client hears it like, that's not my story.
Right.
And there's a big disconnect. Mm-hmm. And so I'm stoked about that. Oh, here's a final, actually one other question. Because like, I was thinking about like ski camp, but it's been like, because now you're at ski camp. So we're training in the morning, ski during the day, train at night. So what has been we've been here for a few days so far. I know you have to leave a bit early because you have big things happening at home, but what's been your highlights of ski camp?
Well, first of all, the people in ski camp are awesome. You know, the lawyers here, we've got a young lawyer here who's a law student.
Cameron,
who's a law student, and to the more senior lawyer like
myself. You!
the whole gamut, and everybody here is wonderful and here to learn. and is open to learning and is open to criticism. And you know, the camaraderie is awesome. We also have here some really tremendous vendors, people who care about our clients, people involved in marketing and funding, and it's just a beautiful, you know, friendly environment. We're in an unbelievable magical lodge that, you know, is like a dream of a place. In Big Sky, Montana.
Special shout out to Nick and Courtney Raleigh for letting us have their place as we do our boot camp for to defend, you know, to beat down Uber. We're going to beat back. I'll contribute a little bit.
Exactly.
In our defense of the Constitution, the Sixth Amendment, right to jury trial.
Yeah. So it's a great blend of everything. I mean, we work hard. You know, we're up at the crack of dawn, training for hours. And then, you know, race off to the slope and have an amazing ski day, come back, train for a few more hours, have a massive, beautiful meal. We had homemade gumbo.
Gumbo, that was Aaron
homemade
from HMR.
From Aaron.
You were talking about those financial stress early on with the money. If you had HMR planning, then you'd really be like, fuck you, it's not even my money. I really am willing to go to trial because it's risking my own money now.
I didn't have to fund all my cases. You didn't tell me this.
I didn't know. I didn't.
Aaron will come up with all this money and low risk and... You know, it'd be, I can't wait. I can't wait to, you know, borrow some money and try some of these cases rather than use my own money.
And have Tim help you find them.
And now Tim is going to get me all this business because he's an amazing marketer.
See that?
But it's just really, I can't speak any higher of the program than I am. I mean, it's just been tremendous.
Thanks. Been having a great time myself. And so if people want to get a hold of you, Melissa Scaratelli, what's the best way?
Scartelli.com is
there
my
is.
Website.
Scartelli.com. All right. It's about to be way better pretty soon.
Yes.
After the Blue Summit re-engineers.
Well, we'll see. Hope so.
All right.
It's going to be fun.
Thank you.
Ready to train with the Titans and set records with your verdicts? Register for our live conferences and boot camps at TrialLawyersUniversity.com. Start getting your reps in before the big event by going to TLUOnDemand.com to gain instant access to live lectures, case analysis, and skills training videos from the trial lawyer champions you love and respect, as well as pleadings, transcripts, PowerPoints, and notes for a roadmap to victory. Join the group that continues to get extraordinary results. Trial Lawyers University, produced and powered by LawPods.